Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast for outdoor people. Mountaineering is a tremendous source of stories and inspiration for all of us. And it's one of the paradoxes of mountaineering, I think, is that disasters often make a much better story than success. And throughout sort of the history of mountaineering, there have been great tales of daring disaster and heroism. The great stories about what happened on the Eiger in the 30s, and then later on as Himalayan exploration grew, great tales of heroism and risk as well, which was an inherent part of all mountaineering. There would be no adventure without risk. So my guest today is a man who took part in what I think is one of the iconic stories of mountaineering, one of the iconic events that took place in the Andes. And I almost hesitate to do this, but I can't think of any other way of introducing. My guest is, of course, Simon Yates, who is the man who cut the rope on Joe Simpson. And there's no other way of saying that, really. Hello, Simon. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How about yourself?
I'm fine, thank God. I hope you didn't mind me introducing you in that way. I couldn't think of any. There's no avoiding it. It's the elephant in the room, really, isn't it?
No, there's no avoiding it. And at the end of the day, it's just a statement of fact, isn't it, really?
I suppose so. One of the things I wanted to ask you, if you set the scene, I'd like to talk more about your sort of mountaineering career and what's happened to you and your life. But that was a seminal moment within it. Tell me, what was the story so far when you went to the Andes? Where were you in your sort of mountaineering career and development?
I was at the beginning, I guess. Yeah. So that was the first big mountain that I went to, you know, the first mountain outside of Europe, basically. So, yeah, that was very, very early stage of it. And obviously at that point, you're still on a steep learning curve as well, on a very right. steep learning curve, jumping up from the Alps to climbing in the greater ranges.
And do you think, you think you were relatively inexperienced at that point. Do you think that influenced what happened?
Oh, yeah, completely. You know, we made a lot of mistakes, basically. And a series of mistakes, I think, led to Joe's, initial accident when he broke his leg. And from then onwards, obviously, I was kind of firefighting. You know, that was the seminal moment that tipped everything completely out of control. So, yes, there was a run up to that. I look back on it, and know that we were still learning and that we could have done things a lot better. And subsequently, obviously, you do things a lot better.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I always feel that you can't go into an outdoor shop and buy experience. It doesn't come in little plastic envelopes and shiny packages. You know, experience comes often in moments of terror at the end of a rope, really. And it sounds like you were going through that stage, and there's no avoiding that, really. What effect did it have on you then when, I guess, the big change in your life must have been when Touching the Void came out and the sort of fame that gave you. Is that right?
It's kind of had effects on me at various stages. But at the same time, you know, it's not been my lifetime's work, if you like, at telling and retelling this story. You know, my lifetime's work, as I see it, is my passion for climbing mountains, you know, which has become my job, you know, for climbing high and remote mountains. And I've throughout all of it, I've never lost my perspective on that, if you see what I mean. You know, that's kind of where my mind, my thoughts, my main thoughts lie. But obviously, yeah, there's been various stages of it. There was the book initially, which was obviously, it's not my book, it was a best-selling book that was
Touching the Void.
Some people get confused with that because the way the book is laid out, you know, my thoughts, which were written by Joe, you know, it's a piece of journalism basically, are in a different script, aren't they? So some people initially thought that I'd written those and I didn't. They were transcripts, you know, from a talk, from a conversation like we're having now, you know, recorded. And then obviously there was a film, and more recently, I suppose the most bizarrely, there's been a play made of it, hasn't there? You know,
absolutely. I saw David Grieg's play in Inverness, I thought was a fantastic play. He achieved something I thought that was very difficult, in that he brought, he essentially brought the mountain into the stage and showed what happened, because that's an incredibly difficult thing to do.
I was surprised they were able to do it, you know, to make it work. I must admit, I think it's just like they practiced this, maybe wanted to give themselves some sort of strange challenge, didn't they, by doing something like that, almost, because it's not something you would think it would be possible to make work, to bring, you know, the big outdoors, i.e. large mountains, into a cinema, I mean into a theater, and theaters just by their natures tend to be pokey sort of spaces anyway, don't they?
They certainly did.
It's completely the opposite, you know.
But they did it, and I think it was a great piece of work. Were you involved in the production of the play in any way?
I spoke with David Gregg when he was writing it. He came and visited and we chatted. And then I've had little bits of involvement in it, not a lot, but I did go to the opening evening in the Bristol Old Vic, which was fantastic. So that was it was a nice evening out. And I did go and see it, down in, when it was on in the West End in London as well.
I mean, what was it like sitting there watching someone portraying you? I mean, it is quite—I found it quite a very moving play, and it does explore, I suppose, the themes of like risk and sacrifice and the danger. It doesn't miss any of that. How did that feel for you?
It felt good. I thought as well. It touches on that big question that people outside of mountaineering ask all the time, you know, namely, why do you do it? You know, so yeah. and it touches that, you know, there are moments in the play where, you know, that sort of show moments where it explains why you do it. You're doing it for these sort of tiny little moments of sort of euphoric joy, really, where something incredible happens. You know, you get an amazing sunrise, or, you know, just tiny little things that you get every now and then. Yeah, something profound happens, and that's in essence, that's why you're doing it. You're doing it for those moments, and I thought it showed those quite well. The other thing I liked about it was there was quite a lot of humour in it, which is good, because you know, there is generally we climb mountains because we enjoy it, and we have a lot of fun doing it, don't we? So there is a lot of, you know, I laugh a lot on mountains, though. I don't know about you, you know, with the climbing partners. It's a fun thing to do, and we have fun when we're doing it.
Absolutely. I can't remember who said it now, but somebody said the best climbers were the ones who had the most fun, really, weren't they?
You remember laughing a lot, don't you? I do.
I was never the best climber in the world, but I certainly had a lot of fun, you know. You mentioned the kind of moments that have inspired you. What are the other, you know, in many ways, I suppose, the story of Touching the Void was kind of a low point. What's the high point for you then? Or some high points that have stayed with you?
There's lots of things that stay with me, but I think if I'm just going to say pick one moment, as I've been talking about moments there, I'll pick one moment. In 2001, I climbed a mountain in Tierra del Fuego, the island off the tip of South America, with the British artist, alpinist Andy Parkin. And when we reached the summit, it kind of looked like we weren't going to be able to top out on this mountain because of the weather. And we were granted this little weather window, and we managed to climb to the top of it. And we got to the top of it as the sun was setting to the west over the Beagle Channel. You know, an incredible position. And then we were in the mist, and it cleared. And so we got this sunset to the west. And then there was this magical moment where we ended up with a Brock Inspector to the east. You know, I'd never seen a Brock Inspector before. And a Brock Inspector is where your shadow is projected onto a cloud. So there are a pair of us on top of this mountain, and this shadow was projected onto this cloud, I don't know, a mile or two to the east of us. And we stood there waving at our shadows on this, in this cloud in the distance. And it was just, a fantastic moment, very special moment. And I think that always stays, it'll always stay with me.
Yeah, I think there are sometimes, mountaineering does have the ability to sounds a bit of a strange thing to say, but take you to the highs and the lows of life, really, doesn't it? It can show you the best and the worst of things. Is that something you feel?
Within a very short space of time.
About 5 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah, you can be, everything can be, hunky-dory at one moment, and then obviously it can all go wrong the next, can't it? So.
Yeah, one of the things that I always think is a bit strange for sort of leading mountaineers like yourself is that mountaineering is something you do in remote, wild places, often just with one or two other people. And in some ways, it's a very private thing, really, because you're often just tied to one other guy by a piece of rope, and together you experience something pretty unique, really. But Ben, you're about to start a tour, I believe, a speaking tour, My Mountain Life, but you're about to try and take those very private moments, really, and make them public. Does that make sense to you? How difficult that is?
Yeah, it's difficult, but it's nice to be able to do that. And obviously, for me, it's part of how I make a living, really. You know, there are only certain avenues you can go down to make a living out of climbing. You can write about it, you can talk about it, and you can take people to do it. I think there are other kind of much more specialist sort of, ways of making money out of it as well. Some people manage to make a little living out of it by photography or filmmaking. But essentially, writing, talking, and taking people to do it are the big ways of, the mainstream ways of making a living out of it, and I engage in all of those basically at different times. So, as indeed you do, don't you? I think
I do. Yeah, yeah.
I
talk about it. I'm talking about it now. We're talking about it now, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's right. I talk about my bumblings. There's quite a lot of disaster in my bumblings, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, I get the disaster over at the beginning in my talk. So,
yeah, you're all right after that. Well, you had didn't you?
I give the touch in the wind story. I give it sort of 10 minutes, and that's at the beginning of the story, or near the beginning of the story, because it was near the beginning of my sort of elongated story, which has been going on for 35 years now and is still rolling although it's a kind of a bit suspended at the moment because of what's going on elsewhere.
So you talked to what would you, looking back as over your career, then what would you, I don't know, what's the thing that you would be most proud of, do you think?
There's kind of lots of it, but I like what I've been doing more recently, which is kind of, it's very obscure, but I kind of like that. But I like the sort of exploratory mountaineering that I've been doing in the deep south down in Tierra del Fuego.
Tell us a bit about that.
And in the far north up in Greenland. They're just, I'm drawn to those places now.
So
kind of few other people even tread, they even bother going there, basically. So
you're going now to the remotest parts of the globe. What attracts you to those places then?
The remoteness and the lack of other people, I think. That kind of notion of you literally are kind of treading where other people have not even trod sometimes,
Right, I mean, that's
certainly
quite...
in Greenland and in Tierra del Fuego. You know, you get off a boat in Tierra del Fuego on a beach somewhere and approach a mountain like that. So it's really it's something quite special and unique. And I've been doing similar things in Greenland as well. So it's a whole package. You know, that it somehow feels like much more of an adventure than approaching mountains in, say, you can go to a remote Himalayan valley, but ultimately people have been living there for thousands of years. You know, people in the mountains of the Himalayas or Central Asia, you know, they've been living there for a long time. So you never really get away from that completely. Whereas you do in these other places.
Right. So, I sort of had the feeling in a way that do you think all the great mountaineering challenges have been done, or are there things that you'd still like to find for yourself, maybe?
No, they're not all been done. There's still, you know, there's still thousands of fantastic challenges out there. There's still, you know, many, many quite high mountains that haven't received a first ascent. And if you get a map of the world out and look, quite a large area of land in the whole world is actually covered in mountains. So there's plenty left it for people to go out. Yeah,
right. You spoke about your writing. You've written three books on it. Tell us about the books that you've written then.
The first book I wrote, Against the Wall, was about a single trip to do a big new route on the Torres del Paine, on the Central Tower of Paine in Chile and Patagonia. So it's a book about big walling, really, and I suppose it's also a book about reaching a point in my life, a kind of a turning point, where I realised that I was either going to have to make a living out of my mountaineering or you know, make it a vacation. Oh, no. Obviously, sometimes it is a bit like a vacation climbing a mountain, but other times it isn't. And yeah, it certainly wasn't on a big wall. You know, a thousand meter vertical rock face is quite hard work. But so that's about, it's a turning point, and it's a moment where my perspective's altered in a clear and precise way, and I sort of documented that through this one trip, and then wrote the second book, The Flame of Adventure, which is actually a prequel. So it's all the kind of early climbing that I did in the Alps, and then and on into to the Himalayas before we got to that point in the Torres del Paine in Chile, and the most recent book,
The Wild Within. Yeah.
Yeah. I've almost forgot the name of my own book then. But
don't worry, it happens to me all the time.
That's about these, essentially it's about these mountain wilderness trips that I've been drawn to over the last sort of 20 years now. I've been at those. So, it's mostly about those, but it documents a sort of 10-year period of my life when I started doing that and got involved in it. So they're the three different books in a nutshell.
Right, it's fantastic, and it sounds very much to me as though your desire for mountaineering and to go to wild places is very much undiminished. Is that right?
It is, yeah, and hopefully that comes across in the books as well. You know, it's there, it's still there, and I write when I want to. I write when I think I've got a story, so I'm not just I don't just go on an expedition and think, right, I've been on an expedition, now I'll write a book. I write a book when I've got a whole package. So
I see. Yeah,
the last book, I knew, you know, I'd got a book, but I hadn't got an ending. So essentially, I waited until I had a trip that provided an ending for the book before sitting down and writing the book. And once that happened, I sat down and wrote the book.
Yeah, it is. I know exactly what you mean. You can't sort of conjure these things out of thin air. They have to sort of, I suppose you have to have something to say in a book, don't you? And that, rather than just sort of catalogue, we went here, we did that.
I, yeah, I hope so. And I think people in the past used to be able, were able to do that, but the whole kind of market, I think, has moved on now. So people are expecting a bit more, as you say, than just we went there, we did that. They want something else from it as well.
Yeah, it's usually, it used to be, we went there, we did that. It was quite hard. That was basically it.
Yeah. And
That was what.
yeah, and then we came home again or what?
That's right. Yeah, then we came home
Yeah.
again. Yeah, that was
Yes.
basically the way it went, wasn't it? Really.
Yeah, well, what's the format, and then but people have got bored of that, basically. The readers had enough of that, so you've got to come up with something a bit more. You've got to come up with something a bit beyond that now. There's got to be a thread. I think you've got to have a thread that runs through a book of that kind nowadays.
Yeah, do you think? I mean, what I'm finding, how can I put it, that I'm drawn more and more to sort of wild places, and I'm less concerned about going up hills these days, as just being in wilderness. Is that something you've experienced? No.
Yeah, I mean, I no, yeah, I still like going up hills though, but yes, I mean, I do just enjoy being in those places. I enjoy being in mountains and wherever they are, so I enjoy the downtime. I can enjoy being sat on a yacht in a fjord in Tierra del Fuego or in a fjord in Greenland. It doesn't, just the place and the positions of. Yeah, fantastic. Like you're saying, in those wilderness places, I enjoy all that goes with it. The wildlife. In Greenland, the whales, I've seen musk oxen and polar bear and things like that. And that's just fantastic to see animals like that in the wild. And then, yeah, down in the far south as well. Just incredible things. Birds and yeah, sea lions and just amazing, amazing wildlife. The fish boiling with, so the ocean boiling with fish, and all these sort of incredible things that happened. That they're all kind of part of it, and they're the lure of those places as well. I mean, what's special about those places is the fact that people haven't messed them up yet, really, isn't it? There are still parts of the world where people haven't had the kind of the impact that they have elsewhere.
Well, I mean, if you think about how many people can have had the sights that you just talked about there, the polar bear, the whales, fish, that's something that you might see it on, I mean, David Attenborough, he's popped over and had a look, but most of us don't get to see those things. So I think that
No,
is
we
quite
don't.
incredible.
I mean, essentially now, like you said, some cameraman and whatever and camera team will go out and they'll look for something like that, and they'll spend months, won't they, sat in a tent or whatever, waiting for something to happen. And I've been lucky enough to see these things for real. So I do feel very privileged, I must admit.
Yes, I've definitely decided that if I had my limited experience of trying to do wildlife photography taught me that if I ever have my time again, I certainly wouldn't want to be a wildlife photographer, because you do have to spend hours, and generally speaking, nothing happens. And like you say, you normally stumble over these things. It is quite strange when you see these things.
Yeah, and it's nice when you do just stumble over them as well. I think in some ways that must it must be nicer than having spent weeks, trying to go and see this particular thing happening, and
Oh,
ultimately
that's
then
right.
that must just be relief when you finally get the pictures, mustn't it,
Well,
really?
there must be a degree of terror when you actually see what you the bear or the musk ox in front of
Well,
you.
the bear, we're very lucky actually, because we're actually leaving a fjord in Greenland, and the bear was in the sea.
Oh,
So,
right.
yeah, it was paddling around. That you know, we were that there was pack that there was ice. There were icebergs, and it was and the seals were actually on some of these icebergs. So the polar bear was paddling around to get to the seals. On these little that
All
were
right.
resting up on these icebergs. That's what the so. yeah, so we could actually look at the thing quite safely, you know, without the worry.
Without the worry it's going to come
over and eat us, basically. Yeah.
there's probably wildlife photographers who have spent years trying to get that kind of shot, you know?
Well, you're just incredibly lucky, you know, like just sort of all of a sudden there was this bear in the way, you know, in the ocean, paddling around in the ocean in front of the yacht. So we followed it for a couple of minutes. But it was scared of us, you know. Wanted to be out of the way, so we didn't follow it for long because it was stressing the bear out. You know, it was puffing away, and so we took a few photos and then left it
and backed off. So
yeah,
what sort of dream trips have you got left? What is it? If you could do one thing, what are you hoping for?
Oh yeah, the one thing I'd really like to do, and I'll sort it out eventually. I'd really like to go to South. I'd like to go and climb on South Georgia.
Yeah,
which will involve a yacht, basically. So
yeah, it's a hell of a place to get to, I believe.
yeah, it takes a while to get there, and it's expensive, basically.
There's the old whaling station there. Is that right?
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
So it's quite a wild. That's a pretty wild place, really. So
Wild place. Yeah, it's about 4 or 5 days sailing from the Falkland Islands to the east of the Falkland Islands. So yeah,
you don't, in the middle of the
South Atlantic there.
So you don't go to easy places, do you?
No. That's the thing. As time goes on, you end up in more and more obscure places that are kind of more difficult to get to, basically.
Now, talking about places it's difficult to get to, your tour starts very, very soon, I think. When's your first date for your tour? My mountain
Wednesday.
Life.
Next Wednesday, I'm in Chesterfield. So.
Oh, right. What's the theatre there? Do you know? I can't remember.
The Winding Wheel, it's called.
Okay. Is that, yeah. And
I've not been to Chesterfield before, so I've been to Chesterfield, but I've spoken in a theatre in Chesterfield before.
No, must admit I haven't. No,
yeah, I used to live in Sheffield, so I used to go through Chesterfield quite a lot. But yeah.
Oh yeah, well, Sheffield's the climbing capital of Britain, really, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
So. There's no doubt about that. So So what I'll do is, I'll put a link to all your tour dates on the website for this little podcast, and so if folk want to come along and hear your story live, it starts in Chesterfield, and then how many other dates have you got? You know,
well, I've got 10 dates altogether. I start in Chesterfield and I finish up in Salisbury.
I'm not going to any.
I've got no dates in Scotland on this tour or Wales. I'm kind of up and down a bit, so
you can always hope, eh? brilliant. Well, I hope that's been fascinating talking to you, and I really hope your tour goes well, and I hope sooner or later you make it to South Georgia. Simon, yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, John.